In our study tonight, we're continuing to talk about King David. We have concluded our study about King Saul, and we've noted that Saul was killed as a result of the battle with the Philistines. He committed suicide, fell upon his own sword. And then we noticed that his armor bearer likewise committed suicide. And we discussed how that those of Jabesh-Gilead, when they found the body of Saul or learned of the Philistines' abuse of his body, they went and retrieved his body and buried him in Jabesh. And then beginning the book of 2 Samuel, we discussed in some detail the beginning of the reign of David as king over the people of God. Now, we've noted that Saul's chief captain, whose name was Abner, yes, appointed Ish-bosheth, the son of Saul, to be king. Now, Ish-bosheth was not to be king. What had happened to the lineage of Saul? God had cut that off, and so he was not to be king. Eventually, we find that Ish-bosheth is killed, Abner is killed, David is recognized as king over the entirety of the kingdom of what we will discuss as Judah and Israel. Now, in our text of 2 Samuel chapter 5, 2 Samuel chapter 5, we know that David was 30 years old, verse 4, when he began to reign, and he reigned 40 years. In verse 5 of chapter 5, it tells us that in Hebron he reigned over Judah 7 years and 6 months, and in Jerusalem he reigned 30 and 3 years over all Israel and Judah. Now, in the discussion of the 5th chapter, we talked about how that David has conquered the city of Jerusalem. Now, this is very, very important to our study, because though kings of Jerusalem have been slain and were slain during the days of Joshua, during the days of the conquest, we know that Jerusalem itself as a city had not been taken. Now, the significance of that is very powerful in our study. Two or three things I want us to remember at the onset of this. One is the location of Jerusalem. In our discussion of the topography, relating that with the geography of the maps that we've been looking at, where is Jerusalem located?
It's about central.
It's about central. That's right. Another thing that we want to note on the where is its elevation. When you consider the elevation of Jerusalem, about what did we determine the elevation was?
2,100 feet.
About so. Between two, maybe the upward side of 2,000 or so feet. But the point that we're seeing is it's located on the top of the hill country, as opposed to the Transjordan Plateau, which ranges about the upward elevation would be near 3,000 feet of the Transjordan area. Then going back toward the Mediterranean Sea, down to sea level, of course. Now, between Jerusalem, at the top of the hill country, as it were, and the Transjordan Plateau, what's in the middle there?
The Jordan Valley.
The Jordan Valley, which reaches the depth of
1,300
feet below sea level. Now, that gets us in some perspective of the ruggedness of the area, the topography of the area. Now, we've mentioned that Jerusalem as a city has not been taken by the people of God before. Why?
It's 1,245.
It's well fortified. That's right. It sets up on the top of the hill. Mount Zion, it's called. And as it sets up on top of the hill, it's well fortified, and We're told that in our text here that the way that David took it was he came up through the water course. You see that in verse 8 of chapter 5? It's my understanding that the water supply of Jerusalem was from springs deep down into the hill. And so consequently, in order to take the city, you had to either come up from the rugged area of the mountains, or David offered to give someone a particular place if they could figure out a way to take the city. And who did? It's presumed that Joab did, who became the captain of David's army, as we read a little bit later and discussed in our study Sunday morning. So, figuring out a way to come up through the spring, as it were, was the means by which the city of Jerusalem was eventually taken. Now, when we look at the... yes, go ahead.
Was there even ever an attempt to conquer Jerusalem?
Not to my knowledge. I know that Joshua fought with the kings, several kings, one of them from Jerusalem, but I don't believe that there was. No, I don't recall a specific battle in the days of Joshua to conquer the city itself, which is interesting. Who was there? We have on the board the Jebusites were there, and we know that when God was speaking unto Abraham in Genesis chapter 15, there beginning about verse 18, the Jebusites were identified as being among the inhabitants of the land that was to be conquered. So it raises the question, well, why didn't Joshua go in and take the city? Why didn't he figure out a way to go up through the water course? I don't know the answer to that. I don't know that the Scriptures address it, but it's an interesting question to explore. But one of the things that we do want to know is that David pulls the empire, as we might refer to it, the kingdom together under his reign, conquering now the city of Jerusalem. Now, as we think about the security of the Jebusites, they had made the bold boast to David that you'll have to fight against our blind and lame because our blind and lame can keep you out of the city. Well, that became a proverbial saying after the city was conquered because David had taken the city. Now, beginning in verse 13 of chapter 5, yes.
What year are we talking about when David took the city, roughly?
David ruled about 1000 B.C.
About 1000 B.C. is when he took the city?
Well, that's when he began his reign. That's when he ruled. And he ruled for 40 years. So, yeah.
Well, you said he only reigned 7 years in Hebron.
7 years in Hebron. Yeah, you can figure that out. Yeah. In verse 5, chapter 5, verse 5. In Hebron, he reigned over Judah 7 years and 6 months, and in Jerusalem he reigned 33 years over all Israel and Judah. So there's the passage you're looking for. 5:5. Second Samuel chapter 5, verse 5. He reigned in Hebron.
40 years?
No. He reigned in Hebron for
seven and a half years,
yes. And then he reigned in Jerusalem for 33 years. So 40 overall.
So essentially they had a divided kingdom way back then. Before.
Sort of. Now keep in mind that, right, during the time right after Saul, we've got a lot of the empire that was lost because of Saul's foolishness. And, of course, even preceding Saul to some degree. And we want to note that after the battle with the Philistines, when Saul and his sons died, the kingdom, for the most part, was in disarray. And so, you just don't have order during the beginning period here of David's reign. He begins then to secure the empire, conquering the city of Jerusalem, moving the Ark of the Covenant to Jerusalem, building his palace in Jerusalem. In the meantime, beginning to expand his empire, driving the Philistines back and several others back into various territories, which we'll see in chapter 8. And so the kingdom begins to reach back where it was when it was given under the leadership of Joshua. Now that becomes significant. We're jumping ahead here a little bit, but you'll notice in chapter 8, in chapter 8 of 2 Samuel, it tells us in verse 1, "And after this it came to pass that David smote the Philistines and subdued them. And David took the bridle of the mother city out of the hand of the Philistines and smote Moab and measured them with the line, making them to lie down on the ground. And he measured two lines to put to death, and one full line he kept alive. And the Moabites became servants to David." In other words, he killed two-thirds of them. And then in verse 3, it tells us that David smote also Hadadezer, the son of Rehob, king of Soba, and went to recover his dominion at the river. Now, one of the things we'll note when we get to that is that he extends his control now up to the river Euphrates, that has been lost in the preceding years. And you'll notice in verse 5, it tells us that when the Syrians of Damascus came to succor Hadadezer, king of the Syrians, 20,000 men, then David put garrisons in Syria of Damascus, and the Syrians became servants to David and brought tribute and so forth. And you'll see that repeated in verse 9 with Toi, king of Hamath. And so we kind of have a domino effect, several victories beginning here in this portion where David is expanding the kingdom and driving those out that have plagued the kingdom up to this point. So you can see then how at the point of chapter 5, the Jebusites would feel secure to chide David and say, well, you know, you'll have to fight the blind folks and the lame folks. They can keep your army out. They've done a good job of it really so far. I mean, when you look at the practicality of it, Saul had not dominated them. Joshua had not dominated them. And so this event with David was quite a significant event to secure the city of Jerusalem. And then, of course, that became the capital of the empire. It became the focal point not only of their government, but also the focal point of their religion, as this is where eventually the temple was built. Now, I want to pass beyond that chart and look just a little bit further. We've noted that David makes Jerusalem his city. In fact, if you go back to chapter 5 and look at verse 9, it tells us that David dwelt in the stronghold and called it the city of David. Verse 10 tells us that David waxed greater and greater, for Jehovah, the God of hosts, was with him. Now, we talked a little bit about that. We noted on this bottom portion of the chart how that the Ark of the Covenant has now been transported from Kiriath-Jearim to Jerusalem, where it is to be kept in what was referred to as the Tabernacle of David. And we'll have to talk about that some more in just a bit as our study progresses, as David makes this suggestion to God that he build the temple. We talked about last time how that Hiram of Tyre sent supplies to David to build for David a palace in chapter 5 in verse 11. But I want to drop down for our thinking for just a moment in verse 13. It says that David took him more concubines and wives out of Jerusalem after he was come from Hebron, and there were yet sons and daughters born to David. Now you'll see some names in verses 14, 15, and 16. I'm not going to attempt to pronounce all those names, but I simply want to bring to your attention that the number of wives and concubines that David had that he took out of Jerusalem, we're not told. But we do know, as you'll turn the page back just a little bit, to chapter 3, 2 Samuel chapter 3, in verse 2, 3, 4, and 5, we read the names of six wives of David. And then you'll note in the passage that we just noted, a plurality, chapter 5, verse 13, a plurality of concubines and wives that he took out of Jerusalem. Now, why would I bring that to your attention? Pardon me? I'm going to drill you on that. Yeah, well, that could be so. Yeah. That's my wife over there.
I know. Because through Moses, God had told them how a king should act, and they weren't supposed to do that.
That's right. And of course, now the passage I'm going to drill you on is Deuteronomy 17. Because we see a laundry list of restrictions during the days of Moses, when Moses had brought them up out of the land of Egypt, before they've ever come into the wilderness, or rather, before they've ever come into the promised land in the wilderness, he told them the day is going to come when you're going to want a king. And this is the kind of king that you will need to be appointed. Not just anybody can be your king. But among those restrictions, we know that they were not to multiply wives. And what do we see David doing? Now, we've already got him with six that we know their names.
Seven
that we know their names. Is that right? Did I miscount that?
Well, Michael.
Oh, yes, Michael. Yes, yes. I didn't include her in the list here. Yes. So we've got six wives of David plus Michael. That makes seven. And then plus the plurality of wives here, which we don't know how many. And then later we're going to read about Bathsheba. Now, the relevance of that is going to be seen when we talk about David repenting of the sin that he has committed by taking Uriah the Hittite's wife and having Uriah killed. We'll need to talk about that because some want to make application of that to today and say, well, though David kept Bathsheba, if you marry and divorce for just any reason under the stars, then you're with this one, then that's all right for you just to keep the one that you were with. And make the argument, well, David kept Bathsheba. Let's be careful of arguments that we make because we've already got identified seven wives that David had. Eight now, if we count Bathsheba, and we don't know the number that he took from those of Jerusalem. So we don't want to make that argument. To be consistent, we'd have to argue that you could have a plurality of wives.
Well, to keep that same argument, you would have to say it's okay to kill her previous husband.
Well, there's a lot of things you'd have to be consistent. That wouldn't work. So we want to make note of that. We'll come back to that in a little bit in our series of studies. But as you turn the page into 2 Samuel, we know that once again David encounters the Philistines in the last few verses of the 5th chapter. Of course, he inquires of the Lord, and the Lord tells him what he's to do. Bottom line, he gains victory over the Philistines. He doesn't just stomp them, but he does drive them back to the coastal area where they are subdued. Now, the 6th chapter discusses the bringing of the Ark of the Covenant back to the city of Jerusalem. And how does David attempt to carry it? And that doesn't work. Why? All right, wasn't to be carried that way. We saw in the picture just here how it was to be carried on the shoulders of those who were priests. And we know that, as we talked about, I believe, Sunday, that Uzzah died because the oxen stumbled and the Ark of the Covenant was about to fall, or certainly wiggled, and God sent, smote, Uzzah there, and he died. You can read that in chapter 6. Beginning in verses 6 and 7. And the reason, very simply, was, as we can read in the text, we sought not God according to His commandment. And therefore, Uzzah died. Yes. Well, you know, that's a question that keeps reoccurring, or a statement, regardless of who we're talking about.
Well, why didn't they know better? They should have known better. And that's a true statement. You know, the information was available. How else did David finally arrive at the conclusion? As we see in 1 Chronicles chapter 13, certainly in 1 Chronicles chapter 15, as we read the account there beginning in verse 12, we did not seek God according to the commandment. And that's why Uzzah died. How did he figure that out? Well, yeah, you go back and read how the ark is supposed to be transported, and you find that out. Why didn't David go back and read about that? You see, one of the things that we noted in Deuteronomy chapter 17 was that the king was to have a copy of the law, and he was to read the law, lest he do this very thing. Okay, so David didn't know. Any questions or comments just here? Yeah.
They lost their understanding of that book rather rapidly, it seems.
Well, yes, and it was to be read to all, strangers and citizens alike, every 7 years. And it was to be read, we know, every Sabbath. It was read in their synagogues as we come into the New Testament. So their familiarity with it ought not be strange, but it was. It was lost. Interesting observation. Well, we talked about Uzzah last time. I want to pass through some of these charts looking at the clock because there are some things I want to talk with you about, specifically in chapter 7. We've talked about the city of Jerusalem being located on top of the mountain, easily defended. We noted that it was to be the religious and political center of the people of God. We've noted that the Philistines obviously did not like the growing strength of the Israelites, but not a whole lot they could do about it. David suppressed them and gained victory over them, and he subdued them, as we mentioned just a moment ago. But this is the chart that I was thinking about, Lynn, when you were talking about the territory. In 2 Samuel chapter 8, here's the Euphrates River up here. And we want to note from Genesis chapter 15, beginning verse 18, that this was the land that was given unto the children of Israel in promise unto Abraham, here in Genesis 15, from the river Euphrates down here to the river of Egypt. But I want you to look. Now, this map typifies the empire of David and during the days of Solomon, at least as far as the geography is concerned. We noted that David recovered this portion, which tells us that it was at one time lost, which was exactly what Moses had told them, and those are the passages in Deuteronomy. Where are they? 4, 8, 28 through 30. 28 through 30. And then, of course, that's what Joshua had told them when he brought them into the land and they conquered it. He said, if you worship idols, what will happen to you? You'll lose a part of it. He'll drive you out. And, of course, that's what these other kings did, Rehob, the king of Zobah. And so David went to recover his dominion at the river, 2 Samuel 8, verse 3. You don't recover something you've never had, do you? Which is evidence that they had at one time occupied that land, and now they've lost it because they are worshiping idols. But this map tells us the area over which David ruled during this time. All right, during the days of David and Solomon, the kingdom was at its peak, particularly during the days of Solomon, as far as riches are concerned. But I want to take you to something else in our study. 2 Samuel chapter 7, before we run out of time, there's so much to talk about here. Beginning in verse 1, it says, "It came to pass when the king dwelt in his house, and Jehovah had given him rest from all his enemies round about, that the king said unto Nathan the prophet, See now, I dwell in a house of cedar, but the ark of God dwelleth within curtains. And Nathan said to the king, Thy heart, for Jehovah is with thee. And it came to pass the same night that the word of Jehovah came unto Nathan, saying, Go and tell my servant David, Thus saith Jehovah, Shalt thou build me a house for me to dwell in? For I have not dwelt in a house since the day that I brought up the children of Israel out of Egypt, even to this day, but have walked in a tent and in a tabernacle in all places wherein I have walked with all the children of Israel. Spake I a word with any of the tribes of Israel, whom I commanded to be shepherd of my people Israel, saying, Why have ye not built me a house of cedar? Now let's pause right there for just a moment. What is it that's troubling David? Now this is an interesting scenario. David wants to build a house. I want to build a temple. I want to build a nice place for the Ark of the Covenant to stay. Now, of course, the Ark of the Covenant symbolized God's presence among His people. Now, question. Was the fact that the Ark of the Covenant was inside of a tent-like structure any evidence that God was not in their presence? No. God was in their presence. All right. That's true. The term tabernacle of David, quote unquote, was a term used to indicate or depict what David had built to house this ark. No, you're right. It was not the tabernacle that Moses built that had been carried around with him. But what we have is a temporary structure to house the Ark of the Covenant. Now, this is troubling to David. But the question that God asked, I think, is one we need to look at. In verse 6, For I have not dwelt in a house since the day that I brought the children of Israel out of the land of Egypt. Now, question, had God ever asked for a house? No. How did David know that God wanted a house to put the Ark of the Covenant in? He didn't. But he thinks he does. He thinks this is what would be a good thing. God said, I never asked for that. The Ark of the Covenant symbolizes my presence among the people. It's been there since the days of Moses. I've been with them since I came with them up out of the land of Egypt. And ask anybody to build for me a house. Now, I think sometimes we see illustrated here, we get a little bit ahead of God in our thinking, like David did. Now, we've noted that David was a man after God's own heart, and that's a good thing. We see some tenderness and compassion, etc., several qualities characteristic of David. But when David expresses the desire to build for God a house, he's expressing a desire to do something that God hasn't asked him to do. He hasn't asked anybody to do that. And if you'll notice the text, beginning in verse 8, he said, Now therefore thus shalt thou say unto my servant David, Thus saith Jehovah of hosts, I took thee from the sheepcote, that is, from the pasture. He was a shepherd. From following the sheep, that thou shouldest be prince over my people, over Israel. And I have been with thee whithersoever thou wentest. And have cut off all thine enemies from before thee. And I will make thee a great name, like unto the name of the great ones that are in the earth. And I will appoint a place for my people Israel, and will plant them that they may dwell in their own place, and be moved no more, neither shall the children of wickedness afflict them any more as at the first. And as from the day that I commanded judges to be over my people Israel, and I will cause thee to rest from all thine enemies. Moreover, Jehovah telleth thee that Jehovah will make thee a house when thy days are fulfilled, and thou shalt sleep with thy father, thy fathers, and I will set up thy seed after thee that shall proceed out of thy bowels, and I will establish his kingdom. And he shall build a house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. I will be his father, and he shall be my son. If he commit iniquity, I will chasten him with the rod of men and with the stripes of the children of men. But my loving kindness shall not depart from him, as I took it from Saul, whom I put away before thee. And thy house and thy kingdom shall be made sure forever before thee. Thy throne shall be established forever. According to all these words and according to all this vision, so did Nathan speak unto David. Now there's just a whole bunch of stuff in that that we want to talk about. David has asked to build a dwelling place for the house of God, or for the covenant, the Ark of the Covenant of God. God has said that I will establish your house. Now we know that involved in that, because it's quoted in the New Testament, in Acts chapter 2, we're going to look at this in greater detail in just a moment, as we've got a slide or two on it, just down the pipe. But for the rest of David's life, we know that he spends time and resources gathering materials for the temple. He's not going to build a temple in Jerusalem, and we're going to see why. His son, Solomon, does. But note what God promises unto David. Your son will build a house. Now, I've asked you to look at parallel accounts from Samuel and the Kings, and look in the Chronicles. And that's at this point, I want you to look at 1 Chronicles chapter 22. 1 Chronicles chapter 22. In 1 Chronicles chapter 22, beginning at verse 6, as David calls for his son Solomon. Now, in 2 Samuel 7, Solomon is not named. We don't know whose son is, or what son is going to build this house in 2 Samuel. But we do know in the account of the Chronicles. In 1 Chronicles chapter 22, beginning in verse 6, it says, then he called for Solomon his son and charged him to build a house for Jehovah, the God of Israel. And David said to Solomon his son, as for me, it was in my heart to build a house unto the name of Jehovah my God. But the word of Jehovah came to me, saying, thou hast shed blood abundantly and hast made great wars. Thou shalt not build a house unto my name, because thou hast shed much blood upon the earth in my sight. Behold, a son shall be born to thee, who shall be a man of rest, and I will give him rest from all his enemies round about. For his name shall be Solomon, and I shall give peace, or I will give peace and quietness unto Israel in his days. He shall build a house for my name, and he shall be my son, and I will be his father, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom over Israel forever. Now let's pause there. David tells Solomon, his son, you're going to be the one who will build a house. And God told me that I'm going to establish that house and establish that throne forever. Now, two or three things we want to see in that. In 1 Chronicles chapter 28, as the thought continues, we see more details. Chapter 28, in verses 2 through verse 10. Verse 2 through verse 10. We know that Solomon is to sit upon, if you'll note verse 8 specifically, it says, verse 5. And of all my sons, for Jehovah hath given me many sons, he hath chosen Solomon, my son, to sit upon the throne of the kingdom of Jehovah over Israel. And he said unto me, Solomon, thy son, shall build my house and my courts, for I have chosen him to be my son, and I will be his father, and I will establish his kingdom forever. Now, let's notice those statements. They're repeated. But let's notice the significance of them. When God tells David, your son is going to build me a house. Well, we know that's going to be Solomon because of these other passages. And we know that the house is going to be the temple. And we know that the temple is going to house the Ark of the Covenant. A host of other things. But what I want you to note just here is that there's more involved in this. It's not just that Solomon's going to build a temple. But when God said, I'm going to establish your house, what was different about David versus Saul? What happened to Saul's house? All right, it was cursed. Saul's house was cursed. What ultimately happened? His sons were all killed. The lineage of Saul was ended. His house stopped. And that was, of course, because of his sin. But we know that David, his house would be established. Now, the significance of that is when we look at the lineage of kings. The kings, beginning with David, would follow through David's lineage to the last earthly king in Judah. Who was that, by the way? Oh, what's his name? Well, that takes us over to the book of Jeremiah, chapter 22. Now, remember the timeline. Jeremiah prophesies against the people of Judah, and he tells them what's about to happen. Same thing's going to happen to you that happened to Israel, the northern 10 tribes, as they were taken by the Assyrians. What's going to happen to you? You're going to be taken captive by the Babylonians. But in all of that, Jeremiah says in Jeremiah chapter 22, we might back up a chapter or two. If you'll back up to chapter 18. No, that's not what I'm looking for. Give me just a moment. I'll put my finger on it. Maybe. Pardon me? Well, I haven't said yet. For now, yes, let's begin in chapter 22, verse 24. In verse 24, Jeremiah says, "As I live, saith Jehovah, though Coniah, the son of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, were the signet upon my right hand, yet would I pluck thee thence. And I will give thee into the hand of them that seek thy life, and into the hand of them of whom thou art afraid, even into the hand of Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, and into the hand of the Chaldeans. And I will cast thee out and thy mother, that bear thee into another country where ye were not born, and there shall ye die. But to the land whereunto their soul longeth to return, neither or thither shall they not return. Is this man Coniah a despised, broken vessel? Is he a vessel wherein none delighteth? Wherefore are they cast out, he and his seed, and are cast into the land which they know not? O earth, 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 hear the word of Jehovah. Thus saith Jehovah, write ye this man childless, a man that shall not prosper in his days. For no more shall a man of his seed prosper, sitting upon the throne of David and ruling in Judah." What did Jeremiah just say? Jehoiakim was king. His son was Coniah. Jeconiah, he's referred to in other texts. He's also referred to as Jehoiachin, the same man, the son of Jehoiakim. But it's during his days that King Nebuchadnezzar would conquer the city of Jerusalem. And he would be written off as childless. No man of his descendants would sit on the throne in Judah and prosper. Now look at what God has said to David. God has said to David, "I will establish your house." What's he promising David? "I'm going to establish your lineage." When you look at all of the kings, from David to Coniah, you see the lineage. They follow the descendants of David. When you get to Coniah, Jeremiah said, "That's the end of your lineage of kings that will sit on the throne in Judah and prosper." What's God through Jeremiah telling David? This house that I'm going to establish. We know that during the time of the prophets, the people of God were not always faithful. But the lineage of David was not extinguished like it was with Saul. Do you see that? Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. You're ahead of me now. There you are. You're exactly right. Yes, sir. You're exactly right. And so what we see David being told in 2 Samuel 7 is the establishment of your lineage of kings, but the throne will be established forever. Now that's an interesting statement. When we talk to those who are premillennial, they believe that Jesus is going to one day return to the earth and set up a millennial kingdom, reign on the earth for 1,000 years. But yet, according to the promise of Jeremiah, that lineage would be cut off as far as earthly throne is concerned. There will be no throne beyond Coniah established of the lineage of David. No earthly throne. Yet, when we look at the genealogies of Jesus, who do we find in the genealogies of Jesus? David, and we also find Coniah. But yet we note that Jesus is king. Now there are several Psalms that I want to look at, but I want to kind of pull this together for sake of time. We'll go back next time and review this. But what we want to do at this point is kind of pull it together. Let's look at Psalms chapter 16. Psalms chapter 16. Who wrote most of the Psalms? David did. Who wrote Psalm 16? David did. Yes, David wrote Psalm 16. 1,000 years before Jesus came, look at what he said. In Psalms 16, I'm going to pick up the reading beginning in verse 7. It says, I will bless Jehovah who hath given me counsel. Yea, my heart instructeth me in the night seasons. I have set Jehovah always before me, because he is at my right hand, I shall not be moved. Therefore my heart is glad, and my glory rejoiceth. My flesh also shall dwell in safety, for thou wilt not leave my soul unto Sheol, neither wilt thou suffer thy Holy One to see corruption. Thou wilt show me the path of life. In thy presence is fullness of joy. In thy right hand there are pleasures forevermore. David said, in reference to the establishment of this throne, that it would involve the raising of somebody from the dead. Now, how do we know that? Well, as we turn into the New Testament in Acts chapter 2. Acts chapter 2. You'll note, beginning in verse 22. Acts chapter 2, verse 22. Peter says, ye men of Israel, hear these words. Jesus of Nazareth, a man approved of God unto you by mighty works and wonders and signs, which God did by him in the midst of you, even as ye yourselves know. Him being delivered up by the determinate counsel and foreknowledge of God, ye by the hand of lawless men did crucify and slay. Whom God raised up, having loosed the pangs of death, because it was not possible that he should be holden of it. For David saith concerning him, now look carefully, I beheld the Lord always before my face, for he is on my right hand, that I should not be moved. Therefore my heart was glad, and my tongue rejoiced. Moreover my flesh shall also dwell in hope, because thou wilt not leave my soul unto Hades, neither wilt thou give thy Holy One to see corruption. Thou madest known unto me the ways of life. Thou shalt make me full of gladness with thy countenance. Where does that quote come from? Psalm 16. David wrote that 1,000 years before Jesus came. Now we read from Psalm 16 and we scratch our heads and say, well, I don't know what David was saying. Well, you don't have to wonder very long because now Peter tells you precisely what David was saying. In verse 29, he said, "Brethren, I may say unto you freely of the patriarch David that he both died and was buried, and his tomb is with us unto this day." Now, noting from Psalm 16, David was talking about somebody being raised from the dead. Was David talking about David being raised from the dead? No. No, he wasn't talking about David. He said, "Being therefore a prophet, and knowing that God had sworn with an oath to him that of the fruit of his loins he would set one upon his throne." How did David know that? He's a prophet. That's right. And we note back, if you'll indulge me just a moment, if you go back to Psalms 132, you read of that prophecy. David knew that. God told him. He wrote it down 1,000 years before Jesus came. Verses 10 through verse 12, that the fruit of his body would be sitting upon his throne. Now in Acts chapter 2, being a prophet and knowing that God had sworn that to him with an oath. Well, we read that back over in Psalms 132. He said, "He foreseeing this spake of the resurrection of the Christ, that neither was he left unto Hades, nor did his flesh see corruption." Now Peter said, when David said these words, who was he talking about being raised from the dead? Talking about Christ.
So I guess what we're seeing here is after Coniah, the emphasis or shift goes from a physical throne to a spiritual.
Yes, sir.
Which makes sense because the kingdom is a spiritual kingdom.
Isn't that amazing though? But don't that just jump off the page at you? That's fascinating. David knew that way back when David was talking about such things as the establishment of his throne and one of his lineage sitting upon his throne. He, foreseeing this, spake of the resurrection of Christ.
I wonder if David understood that it was a spiritual throne and a spiritual kingdom versus a physical throne. I wonder if David understood that at that point.
I don't know the extent of David's understanding, but I do know that David prophesied about one being raised from the dead and sitting upon his throne. Now the Apostle Peter says here in Acts chapter 2, "Being therefore by the right hand of God exalted, and having received of the Father the promise of the Holy Spirit, he hath poured forth this which ye see and hear. For David ascended not into the heavens, but he saith himself, The Lord said unto my Lord, Sit thou on my right hand till I make thine enemies the footstool of thy feet." Where did David say that? Psalms 110. That's right. When David prophesied concerning this new king, that he would be king after the order of Melchizedek. Why was that so unique? During the days of David, could David be a priest? No. But he was king. But he couldn't be priest. But David was prophesying of one of his lineage that would be of the tribe of Judah, who would be both king and priest. Do you see that? Now we have the Apostle Peter saying that this is what David said, and he says in verse 36, "Then let all the house of Israel therefore know assuredly that God hath made him both Lord and Christ, this Jesus whom ye crucified." Who was it that was raised from the dead to sit on David's throne? Jesus was. Now, where is David's throne? In heaven. You see, he's not talking about something physical. He's talking about a place of authority. And he's talking about the Son of God. That's how it can be forever. Yes. That's how it can be forever. Because you see, David understood the nature of physical kingdoms. He wasn't being promised a physical kingdom that would last forever. But he was being promised that there would be a spiritual kingdom that would last forever. And one of his descendants, the fruit of his loins, would be raised from the dead to sit on that throne.
House was established.
That's it. You got it.